Would you join me by opening your Bibles to the book of Galatians, chapter 4? Quick show of hands, how many people every single year have a hard time trying to figure out what to buy someone else for Christmas? Who has a hard time shopping? If you look around, that's like everybody. I have a horrible time trying to do that, but I have some good news. We are not alone. In fact, the American Psychological Association reports that 47% of people all admit to feeling stress during the shopping season of Christmas time. And most of the time, that stress comes from trying to find just the right gift at just the right time. And you know exactly what I mean. My brother excels at that. And I mean to the point where it's annoying. My brother will come up with stuff that even you didn't know you needed. And you open that thing and you go, you know what? I could use one of those. Or that's right, that did break this past summer. And he always seems to have the right gift at the right time. And it's funny how receiving the right thing at the right time can make all the difference. I remember buying a table saw one time. I had it loaded in the back end of my pickup truck, and the truck was backed up to the garage of our house. And I'm standing here trying to figure out how is it I'm going to get this saw down out of my truck and into my garage. Now, keep in mind, this was not your ordinary table saw that you'd pick up at Lowe's or Home Depot or something. This was a woodworker's cabinet saw. And to give you an idea of the size, it was 36 inches across and 24 inches deep, and the top was cast iron. The whole thing weighed in at about 400 pounds, and it took three people to load it down off of a loading dock into the bed of my truck. So here I am wondering, how am I going to do this without killing myself? Well, right as I'm standing there staring at this saw, I hear a voice saying, "Hello, is anybody home?" And then out of nowhere comes my next door neighbor. Now, I had never met my next door neighbor before. He was a truck driver, and I was relatively new to the neighborhood. So this was the first time we'd ever encountered one another. So it didn't even occur to me to knock on his door, but there he was. And he said, "You know, I noticed you were home and we'd never met before. So I figured I'd come over, introduce myself. My name is Andrew. Oh, and by the way, could you use some help with that?" Now, keep in mind, my neighbor was about 6'1" tall and 300 plus pounds, most of it muscle. And I'm looking at this guy and he's saying, "Can I help you with that?" And I'm thinking, manna from heaven. Yes, you can help me with this. How do you think we're going to get this down? And he said, "Oh, don't worry about that. Just stand aside. I'll grab it and just carry it in." And I said, "But this thing's like 400 pounds. Before I could get that out of my mouth, he had bear hugged this table saw and walked it into my garage and set it down right in the spot that I needed. Talk about perfect timing. Well, just like my neighbor showed up at just the right time and had just the right thing, God has a way of showing up at just the right time with just the right thing. You remember the story of Israel coming right out of Egypt, going into the desert, and they run out of water. And you remember the whole nation was on the verge of dying of thirst. And you remember how right at the precipice of no turning back, God sent water from a rock to water the whole nation, and they were all saved. And then just a little while later, they run out of food. And they're on the verge of dying from hunger, and they even start complaining. And it says in Exodus chapter 16, "For you have brought us out into the wilderness to kill us with hunger," they complained to Moses. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I am about to rain bread from heaven." James tells us in chapter 1 of his letter, "Every good gift and every perfect gift is from the Father above." You see, when it comes to giving gifts, God has a way of giving us just the right thing at just the right time. And that's exactly what this message this morning is all about. Because when Jesus came, he was just the right gift at just the right time. And so today we start a three-week series, a three-part message, if you will, looking at the gift of Christmas. And this morning it's the right gift at the right time. And so I asked you to open your Bibles to Galatians 4, and maybe you're thinking to yourself, what does that have to do with Christmas? There's no manger scene in Galatians 4. There are no shepherds or stars or angels. And so I agree, this is probably not the first book you would think of to go to for a Christmas message. But I will venture to say that if you look with me to this verse for just a little while, you'll see why it's such a great place to start when we're looking at the right gift at the right time. And so we're in Galatians. We're only going to look at two verses this morning. Look at verse 4. But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. You know, if it's one thing I've learned about gift giving, it's that even though we say it's the thought that counts, the truth is the wrong gift doesn't get you very far. I will never forget, for as long as I live, one particular Christmas. We had been married just a few years, and my wife is laughing because she knows exactly what I'm about to say. But Owen had just been born that year, so by this time he's 10 months, 11 months old. We're walking through a store, and we're in the jewelry section of the store, and my wife looks up and she sees this little charm, just this little silver charm, but it's in the shape of baby feet. It's baby blue. And she said, I'd love that charm for my bracelet. And so I thought to myself, okay, mental note, I'll get that charm. Later on, I go back to the store with every intention of buying that charm. But then as I'm standing there and I'm looking at everything they have to offer, I think to myself, you know what I'll do? I'll really surprise her. And instead of that charm, I'll get her a diamond necklace. And so I did. And you might know where this was going, but I bought that necklace. I put it in a box, and I put it on the tree. Not under the tree, but on the tree. You know how they do in the commercials where it's this little tiny box, and it's just kind of setting on one of the Christmas tree branches? Well, that's what I did. And I figured I would give it to her at the very end. She wasn't going to see it, and then, oh, there's one more thing, honey, and I'll pull it off the branch, and I'll hand the box to her. And this is how it went in my mind. I'd give her this box, and she would open it up, and she would see the diamond necklace, and she would be so impressed. She would jump up, and she would run across the room and give me a hug and a kiss, and music would be playing, and somebody somewhere is going to say every kiss begins with K, because that's where we were. Well, I gave her the box, and she opened the box, and she pulled the necklace out of the box, and I thought, oh, here it comes. And she looked at me and she said, thanks. But what I really wanted was that charm. Perfect timing, perfect execution. But because I didn't listen to what she said, I had the wrong gift. And so I did the walk of shame back to the jewelry store, returned this diamond necklace for a charm. The guy thought I was nuts. But I learned that day, you don't get too far with the wrong gift. Well, when God sent Jesus to earth, he was the right gift. He was exactly what people were craving. He was what people were crying out for in their souls. And if you look at verse 4, it gives us a little bit of an understanding as to why he was the right gift. Notice it says that God sent forth his Son, born of a woman. You see, because Jesus was sent by God, that means he came from heaven. And because he came from heaven, that means he's perfect. He's sinless. He's eternal. But at the same time, because he was born of a woman, born under the law, it means he was also human. And as a human, he was able to die for the sins of all mankind and do what it goes on to say in verse 5, to redeem those who were under the law. You see, no matter how great the gift may seem, if it can't do the thing it's intended to do, if it doesn't produce the result it's expected to produce, it isn't the right gift. You see, Jesus was the right gift. But, and this is the focus of this morning, he was also the right gift at the right time. Notice what it says at the very beginning of verse 4. But when the fullness of time had come. And you notice that phrase, the fullness of time. A lot of people have the question, why is it that Jesus came when he did? Why didn't he come before? Why didn't he come right after Adam and Eve sinned? Why didn't he come today? Why is it that Jesus came right then? John the Baptist said in Mark chapter 1, the time is fulfilled and the kingdom of God is at hand. And here Paul writes, when the fullness of time had come. So what made this time the right time? Well, there's several reasons. Five that we're going to look at this morning. We'll look at each one fairly quickly. But I think you'll get a picture of why this was the time. First of all, it was the right time nationally. You remember King Solomon, the son of David, the king of Israel, the guy who wrote the Proverbs of Wisdom that we read even to this very day? Well, when he died in 930 BC, his two children, his two sons, took over the kingdom and they divided it into civil war. It divided into the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah. Well, soon after that division, the whole area was invaded by Assyria, by Babylon, by Persia, by Greece. And by the time Jesus is born, Rome is in control. Imagine what it might be like to wake up one day in your own country, but to realize you now report to a foreign leader. That's exactly what was going on back in the early 1700s and mid to late 1700s. America fought a revolutionary war because the people were tired of waking up here in the States and answering to the King of England. We didn't want to live that way anymore. We wanted to be free. And so now when you look at our American flag and you see those 50 stars and you see those 13 stripes, what do we think about? We think about our country. We think about the 50 states and the 13 colonies. We think about freedom. We think about our Constitution, our right to self-government. We think about the fact that we're free to choose our own leaders and to make our own laws and to do things our way and not the way of some foreign king. Every single person here was born into freedom. But if you were alive during the time of Jesus, you would not have been born into that. In fact, for 900 years, they had not known that. For 900 years, every day they woke up, they answered to some king somewhere, some foreign lord, some foreign god. And so after almost a millennia of living that way, they were ready for a change. And so it was the right time nationally. Second, it was the right time spiritually. Because just like the people had been living under the rule of a Roman lord, they were also living under the rule of religious law. Now, we have law in America. We have laws that tell you how fast you can go on the roads, and we have laws that tell you to pay your taxes and how high you can build your fence and what you are able to do and what you're not able to do. But there's a big difference between our laws and their laws. Our laws don't require perfection. Our laws make allowance for grace and extenuating circumstances. But the law of Israel didn't. It required absolute perfect obedience all the time, and nobody could do it. Paul even tells us in Romans chapter 3, all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And since no one is perfect, no one can keep God's perfect law perfectly, and every time someone failed, every time somebody oopsed, every time somebody forgot one of the 613 different commands they lived by, there was some zealot, some Pharisee, some religious leader standing over their shoulder saying, you did that wrong, shouldn't have done that, you messed up again, you missed the mark, you're not good enough. You remember the time the Pharisee and the tax collector went into the temple to pray? It says in Luke chapter 18, two men went up into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee prayed, God, I thank you that I am not like this man, this sinner, this tax collector. People couldn't even pray without being beaten down by some high and mighty priest of an impossible system. And if it's something that I've observed, it's that chronic negativity never causes a positive result. It just breeds more negativity until the person eventually shuts down altogether. There was a man who bought a new house, and he was so excited to move into his new house. He got all his furniture in, and he got his couch set up, and his TV set up, and his kitchen set up, and he had everything ready to go, and he sat down, and he noticed his house was just a little bit crooked. Well, he thought to himself, there's no way I can sell a crooked house, so I'll have to fix it. Only nothing he tried worked. So he thought, well, if I can't fix the house, I'll fix the furniture, and I'll prop up one end of the table, and I'll lower one end of the couch, and we'll try to make it at least look level. But none of that even worked. And so eventually, the man stopped trying. And there came a day where he stopped even noticing he was living in a crooked house. And that's kind of what Israel is going through right now. They've been under oppression for so long. They've been under a crooked system for so long. The people have stopped noticing. And they've started to shut down. And by this point, they have shut down altogether. Now, there's no Bible passage that'll tell you that. But I think if you read from what isn't there, you'll agree these people had given up hope. And I say that because between the book of Malachi, which is the last book of the Old Testament, and the book of Matthew, which is the first book of the New Testament, there's only one page. But that one page represents 400 years of silence. 400 years of nothing. 400 years, not one prophet. 400 years, not one verse of Scripture. 400 years and nothing but silence. And it's almost as if the people had just given up. They're living in a crooked house and they figure this is how it will always be. And so when Jesus shows up, they're starving. And it's the right time spiritually because these people are craving some kind of freedom, some kind of hope. Third, it was the right time culturally. And I say that for a couple of reasons. First, because for the first time in the history of the world since about the time of the flood, people were connected with a common language. Now, if you think all the way back to Genesis 11, and if you come to our Wednesday night study, then you know the Tower of Babel and that story. And how right after the great flood, the people of the world were commanded by the Lord to spread out, to multiply, to fill the earth, to subdue it. Only they decided they weren't gonna. And so they just kind of hung around one area. And they thought to themselves, you know, if we can build a tower and it shows God how impressive we are and how strong we are, then he won't be able to make us do anything we don't want to do. And so they started building the tower. And it says in Genesis chapter 11, verse 1, now the whole world had one language and the same words. And using that language, they concocted this plan where they would show God their pride. Well, he doesn't do well with that. And so he comes down, and as a punishment, he forces these people to spread out. And it says in Genesis 11, 8, so the Lord dispersed them over the face of all the earth. Therefore, its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language. And so people no longer spoke the same language. If you were from that country and I'm from this country, we can't communicate very easily. And it was that way for thousands and thousands of years. But then, in the year 356 BC, something interesting happens. A baby is born. And his parents thought he was great because they named him Alexander. And he would grow up to lead Greece. And he led the conquest of most of the known world at the time. And as a part of his conquest, he instituted Greek as the international language of choice. So any child born would be brought up speaking their native language and the Greek language at the same time. Now, if we want to talk and we're from different countries and you don't speak my language and I don't speak your language, we can both speak Greek and we can figure out what we want to do. There's even an example in the Bible of that very thing happening. The Apostle Paul has been arrested, and most of the court he's about to answer to are Egyptian. And in the book of Acts, chapter 21, it says in verse 37, as Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, he said to the tribune, "May I say something to you?" And he said, "Do you know Greek?" You see, language is vital. You can't communicate the message of the gospel if the person hearing you doesn't know what you're saying. I met a missionary couple one time who deals with this very thing. Their mission is to go into tribes of South America and Africa, often tribes that have never seen an outsider. Often tribes at the same time with little to no written language. They have oral communication, but nothing in writing. And it's this missionary's couple's job to go into those places and give them the Bible. Well, without a written language, you can imagine that's impossible. And so they will spend years, and the husband told me one time, sometimes upwards of 10 years giving them a written language. And what I mean by that is exactly what it sounds like. They take their oral language and they will create individual letters to represent sounds. They will make the grammar, they'll make the punctuation, they'll teach the people how to use it, and then eventually they come to the point where they can translate the Bible into that new language. Right now in the world, if you wanted to conduct business across international boundaries, the current language of use is English. And so if you're from one nation and someone else is from another and you don't speak the same language, everything is done in English and you can do a deal. Well, back then, Greek did that same thing. And so for the first time in a long time, people spoke the same language. But second, the world was on the verge of an explosion. And by that, I mean a baby boom. And a baby boom unlike anything the world had ever seen. I read this past week that in human history, approximately 105 billion people have lived throughout time. Now, right now, it's about 6.5 billion people on the planet. But if you add up all the years of human history, you'll come to about 105 billion people. But here's the thing that caught me. Less than 2% of all the people who have ever lived, lived before the birth of Christ. That means 98% of all of humanity has lived in a time where the gospel could be communicated internationally. 103 billion people living in a world influenced by Christ. And so even though there was way more time before Jesus, it was the right time culturally because there would be way more people after him. Fourth, it was the right time internationally. Just like for the first time and almost ever, the world was connected by a common language, for the first time ever, the world was connected by a common system of roads. You see, Rome ruled much of the world at the time of Christ, and they needed to move their army. Well, it's very hard to move your army over a mountain or through some woods, and so what they would do is create roads. And Rome did a very good job of that. Some of those original roads are still there to be seen and walked on, even to this very day. Rome created about 250,000 miles of roadway just to move their army. Well, when there was no war, civilians would use those roads, and they were able to travel faster and farther than ever before. And so not only was there the roadway, but there was also a sense of peace. And that came also from the Roman army, because they used their army to establish something you might remember from history class as being the Pax Romana. It was a militarily enforced peace all over the region where they would station their soldiers, kind of like cops, all up and down the roads and in the cities, and they would force a level of peace among the people. And so not only could the gospel travel farther and faster than ever before, and not only could it travel in a language that could go to places like never before, but it could do so more safely than ever before. It was the Pax Romana, for example, that let the Apostle Paul go all over on his missionary journeys. He went to Corinth, to Galatia, he went to Philippi, he went to Rome, and all over and everywhere in between. He could only do that traveling because of the peace provided by the Roman army. It was the Pax Romana that let Jesus travel back and forth from Judea to Galilee and even into the nation of Samaria, if you remember from John 4, where he has a very interesting conversation with a woman by a well. It was the Pax Romana that allowed Joseph and Mary to leave Nazareth and go to Bethlehem for the census where Jesus would be born. It was the Pax Romana that saved Jesus' life as an infant. You remember what happened with King Herod, how he found out that the king of the Jews had been born. In his mind, he's thinking, this is a guy who's going to take my throne. And so he orders that every boy 2 years old and younger be killed. Well, what happens in Matthew 2 is an angel of the Lord appeared, it says in verse 13, and said to Joseph, "Rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt." Well, it was the Pax Romana that made that escape possible to begin with. There was a lot going on in the world that made this the right time. One author kind of summarized it all into a paragraph where he writes, "Christ came when the world was ready for his coming. The Greeks had provided a common language and culture for sharing the gospel. Through the might of the Romans, there was safe transport for spreading the gospel. But most of all, sinners were ready to be released from their bondage. The Gentiles were tired of serving the old pagan gods. The Jews were weary of being held prisoner by the law they had tried and failed to keep for over 1,000 years. So it was at just the right time, not a moment too soon, not a moment too late." And so it was the right time nationally. It was the right time spiritually. It was the right time culturally. It was the right time internationally. And finally, as we close, it was the right time divinely. And what I mean by that is it was the right time simply because it was the time that God picked. And that by choosing that time, he sanctified it to be something divinely special. He gave it meaning that it didn't have before. You see, if Jesus had been born at just any old time in history, if it was any different time in history, then everything we just talked about would have been coincidence. But because God sent his son at that very time, he filled that moment in history with meaning that it never would have otherwise happened. That's how God works. He takes the most mundane things in life. He takes the simplest things in life and he transforms them into something special simply because he used it for his purpose. You remember when God called Moses at the burning bush? There was nothing inherently special about where that bush was located. It was on a mountainside. It was in the wilderness. Moses probably passed this area hundreds and hundreds of time on end. And as far as he was concerned, it was just another spot on the mountain. But as soon as God used that spot for his work, you remember what it said in Exodus 3. He says, "Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you stand is holy ground." There's nothing inherently special about bread and wine. But when Jesus used those to institute the Lord's Supper, he made them special. He gave them new meaning. There's nothing inherently special about a manger. During that time, it was just a hollowed out piece of stone used to feed animals. But as soon as the Lord filled that void, it became special. He gave it meaning. The same is true for lives. Jesus can fill even the most empty heart, and he can transform even the most simple lives into something more special than we could ever imagine. And I believe with all my heart, he still does that very thing. That just like he had the power to transform lives when he walked the earth, and just like God transformed lives all throughout the Old Testament, I believe the power of the message of the gospel still has the ability to change lives today. And if you'll let him, he'll change yours. If you'll receive that gift, then he'll change yours. If you let him fill that void, then he will fill it like nothing else ever could. Maybe you've been too busy. Maybe you look back and You say, well, you know what, it was just never the right time for me to develop a relationship with the Lord. Or maybe I was too busy. There was a lot going on. There was this and there was that, and I had this happen and work, and then I was sick. Whatever it was, there was something, and it just didn't work out before. I would say, I understand, but that was then and this is now. And if you will receive the gift that Jesus has given, I think you will find that there is no time that is not the right time. And today could be your right time. If you don't have a relationship with Jesus, if you think back on your life and you can't think of a time when you intentionally gave your life to the Lord, then I would submit to you that this is the right time. And you can receive that right now as we pray.